Greetings and welcome to On the Brink Radio, broadcast number 303. Yes, that was Wee Moi playing my flute there. I'm sitting here at one of my very favorite spots in Australia, a very sacred power spot at the eastern side of Maitland Beach, Booty National Park. I'm sitting really next to one of my very favorite rocks in all of Australia. It's a giant sandstone boulder with all kinds of interesting sort of coral-looking patterns, and I've hung out with him many, 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 many times. This is the first time I've recorded a show sitting here, and the air has cleared a bit in the past hour. Today was quite just like a solid gray mass of cloud that I wasn't sure if it was cloud or smoke, but now I can see bits of blue sticking through. It's still quite smoky, as you probably are very aware. The most serious bushfires in Central Australia and probably in the 20th and 21st century, or since the Europeans have been here. See, that's one of the things we don't really know about what was here before we can remember. And we assume that the things of today are just like what was before. And we just don't really know what normal is. I mean, it's abnormal. It's kind of like a statistical probability or average that really in reality doesn't even exist. But I'm very blessed to be here after a beautiful month in Apollo Bay, Victoria, where I was embraced by Gadubanud and Kulasuchas and all kinds of nice people. And then I was able to go to Tasmania twice this time. First for a week in Deloraine, where I saw more platypus than in 20 years, and then I returned and went to Montague to stay with my friend Craig Gabo Garland and his beautiful family and learned about the wind farms, and he's going to take us out to Three Hammock Island in the honor of my brother Rob Alliston at some point. Then I was able to go, thanks to my dear brother Alfred Franzen, who loaned me his beautiful Saab convertible, which is by far the nicest car I've ever driven. It's solid. It sounds like an airplane. And it handles really well, has zero beeps. That's what I really liked about it. No beeps at all, not even a click for the turn signal. But went camping in Bay of Fires and Mount William, very, very beautiful, powerful, sacred area in the extreme far northeast of Tasmania. Pretty much completely away from electricity for a week. I just had to pick my camera bag up because I thought the ocean was going to get it. Sort of just above the wave line where the tide still seems to be coming in a bit. I'm going to have to watch that. As most of you know, this area, all of north central New South Wales and southern Queensland, has been engulfed in huge fires. And because I'm actually headed right much closer to it tomorrow, I think the universe wants to put me in the proximity of a sacred process similar to, in fact, very similar to the way that I was on the big island of Hawaii last year when the eruption at Kilauea started happening. And I got out of there after it had been going about a week and a half, which was a relief to me. But this is quite similar. This time I'm going to be going and staying in Katoomba, back at the backpacker where I was my first week here about 3 months ago, in the exact same room. And this time I'm going to be able to look out my window and see the ridge of the ruined castle, which is the next ridge over from the Three Sisters, definitely within the Blue Mountains National Park. It's just been burning the past few days. It's not out of control, and it's pretty much burned all the bigger stuff, but it's going to be quite freaky. And the smoke, the people there said the smoke is not that bad in Katoomba. It's all coming down onto Sydney in the Gosser area in Newcastle, where I am right now. It hasn't affected my ability to breathe, but you can definitely see it and smell it. And today, I actually noticed a bit of, fine little bit of sort of a snowfall, like of ash coming down on my tent. So some would go, oh, climate change, carbon dioxide, kill the carbon. Kill the people, carbon dioxide, governments help us, new world order we need. We need a one world government who's capable of fixing the climate change problem. But no, ultimately, we need to honor fire. That's why this show is called Into the Inferno, honoring cosmic fire and the plasma kingdom. So we think of fire as something that's really hot and that burns us, and that's very true. I'm not sure what the temperature, I'm not sure if some fires are hotter than others. I'm sure they are, the colors, depending on how oxygen rich it is and what materials are burning. But it's really called oxidative combustion, but it's possible to have combustion without oxygen. You can have oxidation is a chemical process that doesn't necessarily involve oxygen, but it's exothermic, meaning that it releases a lot of heat. So fire is an exothermic combustion reaction that one of our most deep and then powerfully entrenched archetypes as human beings, both as we probably also thought of fire possibly as a supernatural being that people had to, until what we call primitive people didn't know how to make fire. They had to get some when they could and keep it going. In a very similar way to how Nikola Tesla, the only way he could get extremely large amounts of electricity, even for a moment, was from lightning. He didn't have a way to generate it yet. He was working on that. So in the same way that Tesla had to build his research labs at places with powerful lightning so that he could get a bolt and capture it and get it to run some tasks for him there for a while, our ancestors, before they learned how to make fire, had to find something that was burning from lightning or a natural fire, however that would start, which I can't think of any other way that a natural fire would start other than lightning. But so they'd keep the fire going, and it was a sacred thing. It was how they were able to see at night, protect themselves, have some light, cook their food, and possibly as a protection against the evil spirits of the darkness. So anyway, in terms of physics, fire is what we call a plasma. Now people think of blood plasma, but that's a different use of the word. Plasma is the fourth state of matter, but it's not commonly taught in high school science. We've got what we call solid, liquid, and gas, which are the states that we're most likely to encounter in our day-to-day life. We've got solid, it's like the brick, the rock I'm sitting on, your chair, your table. Your body's roughly solid, but it's kind of partly, our bodies, living things are kind of almost a hybrid of solid and liquid, but like solids that can, vessels that contain a lot of liquid. So you've got liquid like, water and any kind of fluids, Coca-Cola. Roundup is a liquid. All different kind of things. Blood, you can have any different kind of liquid can contain anything. The ocean, salt water is a liquid. Water in all its forms is the most mysterious and interesting substance. And I'll call it a being. Water is a being, and Mother Ocean is a being, a planetary being that is the topic of another whole show. Mother Ocean as a terrestrial and extraterrestrial intelligence. Water came a little closer to my feet that time. My camera bag's moved out of the way. By the way, I'm sitting right next to a sandstone rock cliff that looks like it's from about 80 million years ago. And coming right out of it, right at eye level, beside where I'm sitting, is the most beautiful little outcropping of Gotu Kola, Centella Asiatica, growing right out of the rock, cascading down totally vertically with a beautiful cluster of little flowers hanging down at the bottom. It's the most beautiful little outcropping of Gotu Kola that I've ever seen. So beautiful. Physicists and astrophysicists tell us that 99.99999% of all the matter in the universe is plasma. And so that's what stars are made of. Legendary theoretical physicist David Bohm, who was a student of Einstein and one of my top favorite minds of the 20th century. That's Boehm, B-O-H-M. I think he was educated at Oxford primarily. Not sure if he was British or American. Anyway, he did a lot of research. Part of his research had to do with some kind of technical thing that actually made the atomic bomb possible, although he was denied because he was a communist sympathizer or socialist or something nebulous like that. He was denied permission to work on the Manhattan Project with Robert Oppenheimer, and much to his karma and spiritual credit, that's probably a good thing, but his ideas were taken from him, classified, and he was not allowed to present it as his own PhD dissertation because of national security, although he was awarded his PhD later. That sounds a lot like Walter Richman, the guy that developed a lot of energy had to do with atmospheric electricity, and he wrote the book The Lost Millennium about the Atlantean scientist priest doing the solar tap that backfired and burned up a lot of their continent. That's probably quite similar to geophysical and geoengineering activities happening right now. Anyway, Boehm did a lot of work with plasma, and he sort of observed, now this is a very sort of casual condensation of what I've read, but apparently he noticed that plasma almost seemed to act as if it was alive, that the way that the different, because plasma is an ionized, it's a gas that's ionized, and I thought that ions could be either positive or negative. Waiting for a motorboat of fishermen to get out of the way, their sound. I'm sure they don't have a shroud on their propeller. But yeah, Boehm thought that plasma acted as if it was alive. And so when we think of stars being made of plasma, and there's also interstellar and intergalactic filaments of plasma, and see, I thought ions could be both positive or negative charge, because an ion is an atom with a charge on it, because its electron structure is not balanced. So I thought an ion could either have positive ions or negative ions. But so electrons have negative charges. Protons have positive. So this is the model. This is the story. So anyway, I remember also, now this, it's very interesting thinking about fire, because we think of fire, I haven't really got into the archetypes, we think of fire, the inferno, like Hades, hell, burning people at the stake, burning down stuff, burning up your karma. It's a very powerful and ingrained metaphor and archetype in our whole psyche. And it's often associated with negative, like destructiveness and stuff like that, but because fire is a plasma, it's actually part of the most abundant and greatest kingdom of matter, of the material world, the explicate holo movement. Plasma is the Mac Daddy, constituting 99.9 or more percent of everything that exists. But it's lucky that it has the ability to be alive, or to seem like it. Anyway, but this show, this idea of being stimulated by all the fires that I suddenly am now quite close to, and tomorrow when I go to Katoom, I'm going to be a lot closer. I'm going to be right on the very brink of the inferno. I don't think I'll be in any danger, but I'll be able to look out my window and see stuff burning. So hopefully I'll get some really good photos and be safely back to New Zealand next Thursday, a week from yesterday. But this show on plasma is tying in a lot of different things. There's a guy named Garrett Verscher, that's V-E-R-S-C-H-U-U-R, who we got in touch back in the mid-1980s, because he was an astrophysicist and radio astronomer from England, no, from South Africa, but teaching at a university in Tennessee. And he was very interested in Dr. John Lilly's dolphin communication work, so we communicated along those lines. For a while, I communicated with him and the Jacques Cousteau of New Zealand named Wade Doak for a long time there. And Garrett sent me an interesting article that he had published in Nature magazine about a correlation that he had seemed to notice between peaks in the 11.2-year sunspot cycle and outbreaks of previously unseen strains of influenza. Now, I thought that was very, very interesting. But his main work was in interstellar and possibly intergalactic magnetic fields. And so this would be, I can't remember if the magnetic fields were contingent upon there being plasma or vice versa, but it seemed related. And so plasma being ionized is highly magnetizable and electromagnetic and capable of conducting and possibly generating all kinds of electromagnetic currents. Now, it makes me think there's he was a Norwegian guy whose last name is Birkeland, B-I-R-K-E-L-A-N-D. Birkeland, he was an explorer. He went to the Arctic to study the auroras and stuff. Well, he came up with the idea of these things called Birkeland currents. They're like plasma filaments in the Earth's, I think they're in the ionosphere. But they form into sort of filaments and rubs and stuff like that. And then there was another guy named Hans Alfven that did a lot of work relating to geomagnetotelluric currents and stuff like that. But the work of Birkeland and Alfven are both extremely relevant to understanding the dynamics of the Earth's, not even just the Earth's gaseous chemical atmosphere, but the electrically charged ionosphere. But the electrical aspects permeate all through the different layers of the atmosphere. We've got the troposphere, the mesosphere, the stratosphere, the ionosphere. But the electrical currents, like the thunderstorms and the electrojet and lightning and all of our artificial transmissions, microwaves, radio, AM, FM, all the stuff is penetrating through the atmosphere all the time. All the stuff I'm talking about with plasma and Birkeland currents and all this different stuff is very key to understanding the physiology of Mother Earth as a living being. And it ties in with the climate change thing and all the geoterrorism, because all the stuff that I'm talking about is exactly the kind of stuff that all these scientists have been researching for decades, not from the point of view of just understanding or of healing our relationship with Mother Earth, but for exploiting and turning her into a Frankenplanet. And especially the weather modification, the geoterrorism thing at the planetary level, as I've been outlining in my last show, geoterrorism and the Atlantean discontinuity, and Sherlock Holmes finally solves the climate change mystery. So you can look at all these fires like any other natural disasters. It is horrific, but it's not unnatural. And a natural disaster, anything a million times worse than this could happen. But if there was no people there to be affected or to have their TV cameras focused on it, would it be a natural disaster? Sure, it would be a disaster. Disasters for all the life forms, the trees and the animals and the plants and the insects and the reptiles and everybody who's lost their lives. But it's been part of nature from day one. And so this is part of the whole strategy of the geophysical warfare thing, the Brzezinskian technotronic era paradigm, is that the average person can't tell the difference between an engineered natural disaster or industrial accident and one that happens spontaneously or naturally. So this is why this whole paradigm is being used in many, many different ways. But there's a very interesting guy, he's Japanese, Dr. Claudio von Werloff, just published an article that he wrote. It's called Confessions of a Climate Scientist, and he has some very interesting things to say. He's still towing the apple cart a little bit by trying to kind of still say that there is some warming from carbon dioxide, blah, 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 and all this stuff, which is maybe true to a bit, but he does make some really good points. He admits that even though that little bit of greenhouse effect from the carbon dioxide may create some warming, it's not necessarily going to have anything to do with any kind of surface temperature, especially not any kind of linear causal relationship as it's often portrayed as. So that's another whole point that we've never gone into in detail with Sherlock Holmes, is the validity of an average temperature for something like the Earth, whether you're talking about the surface or anywhere on it. and the atmosphere and the lithosphere and the ocean. So we've got all these fires going on, and it's causing a lot of property damage and chaos and stuff like that. And luckily, I'm going to have 4 days of being relatively close to it, and it'll be very interesting. But I'm sitting right next to the ocean right now, and the ocean dip I had about an hour ago is probably the nicest one I've ever had. So anyway, in terms of the mass media presentation of this whole thing, there's been a long-standing dictum, that's a funny word, dictum, in the editorial community of newspapers and TV and stuff, and it's like they're imperative. If it bleeds, it leads. So anything that shows blood and gore, accidents, body parts, people being traumatized, damaged, shooting, killing, hurting each other in any way, heads rolling, feet flying, eating of bodies, anything like that is the dominant way to get headlines that capture people's attention. Here comes that stupid motorboat again. Why the fuck is it coming back? But now, in addition to if it bleeds, it leads, in the world of today in California, in Australia, in the recent years, if it burns, it earns. So now anything that's burning is going to be worthy of a lot of advertising dollars to get in there with the people that want to see all the stuff that's on fire and burning up and all the animals fleeing and people running in there with their clothes on fire and stuff. And I'm not trying to make light of all this because it is extraordinarily serious, and I'm going to be quite close to it myself. But luckily, I'll be airlifted out next Wednesday. And it'll be, I know that it's also been raining a lot on the South Island where I'll be flying to. So it's very interesting. I've been watching a lot of interesting reports about people that are analyzing the weather anomalies and these sort of clearly obvious engineered patterns in the jet stream and stuff that you can see that I actually felt down in Apollo Bay in Tasmania. That's like they're deflecting a lot of the moisture and stuff that would normally be going across the mainland of Australia. They're deflecting it down south and keeping it dry. And so you go, well, what's this all about? Why would they want to destroy the east coast of Australia? And so I sort of covered that in last week's show. Your guess is as good as mine, but disaster capitalism, like Naomi Klein says, well-placed parties can benefit, especially if they happen to know ahead of time when something's going to happen, which that itself would mean that they're actually involved with making it happen. But this is the world we live in. But this show is just kind of like throwing out a lot of ideas for stuff to think about, but honoring the kingdom of plasma, because that's what most of the matter in the universe is. That's where our light and heat that makes life possible comes from, the sun, a plasma beam. All the stars are plasmas, and there's some really interesting work by a scientist at Los Alamos National Laboratory named Anthony. Now, it's P-E-R-A-T-T. I'm not sure if it's Perat or Parrot or anyway, but it's Anthony P-E-R-A-T-T, and I've known of him for a long time from my friend John McGovern, who was this kind of far-out dude in South Australia. He's the only person I know that had two wives. And they actually seem to be getting along there for a while. But he was a big fan of the plasma universe and the whole electric universe theory as popularized. It's clearly kind of an offshoot of the work of coherent catastrophists like Emanuel Velikovsky and people like that. But Wallace Thornhill and David Talbot are the two people behind it now. And my friend Richard K. Moore talks about this a lot with respect to what really drives long-term variations in the climate of the Earth. But, you know, it's actually, what is climate? You know, and to separate out climate from other factors too, or to separate out temperature or heat as the only important aspect of climate, that's kind of bogus too, because you've got many other equally important variables that never get talked about. One of the many Swiss cheese holes in the whole climate change thing. But anyway, Anthony Parrott noticed that a lot of rock art all around the world seemed to have this kind of very similar little, what looks like a little stick man squatting. And this pattern, to cut to the chase, this pattern is very similar to the geometrical structure that plasma discharges form anywhere from the micro level to the macro level, like in the laboratory or in the universe, and it's kind of like the shape of a person. You know, so this kind of hints at a lot of freaky possibilities, possibly relating to why we're the shape we are, and are we walking plasma columns in the same way that a guy was reading the other day was talking about how trees actually have the energy, the telluric currents. The Birkeland currents are the telluric currents of the atmosphere. Telluric currents are electromagnetic currents that flow in the earth and the sea. That's T-E-L-L-U-R-I-C. Birkeland currents are the same thing in the atmosphere. And apparently there's huge voltage gradients that are between different layers in the earth. And I'm not sure. And apparently the earth acts like a giant capacitor that can store up charges and then it can be released. This is the kind of thing that Nikola Tesla was sort of born already knowing, or else it was implanted into his brain by aliens. But the little squatting man is very interesting because he appears on every continent. And so what these guys are saying, Talbot and Thornhill, they're saying that our ancestors, and this relates with the cataclysmic evolution hypothesis of Emanuel Bielakowski, they're saying that the not only were the skies, the heavens, particularly at night, a lot different than the ones we see now, not even because of stars being in a different position, which that wouldn't really be that different, but the presence of other bodies like planets in different positions, maybe comets that were there, or other beings, other celestial bodies that were frequent passers, like Comet Encke that was a super comet, or there was also the idea that Earth used to be one of the moons of Saturn. So, I mean, we don't know. There's all kind of ancient information that talks about stuff like this, but it's quite, because it's not in languages that people really are familiar with today. This is where Bielakowski was superlative, because he was a scholar, knew a lot of different languages, and also networked with a lot of the top minds of the 20th century. But the squatting man looks like a little man, but what they're saying is that our ancient ancestors might have seen patterns like that in the sky formed from electrical discharges, whether it could be auroras or Birkeland currents or electromagnetic sort of thunderbolts of lightning discharging between comets and planets, or between planets and, you know, and this is also the origin of the Theomachy, the War of the Gods, you know, and then how this would affect life on Earth a lot of times, because when you could see this stuff happening, it was probably not only scary, but because it was actually having impacts on the Earth, like fires might be starting if there was a lot of, you know, sort of electromagnetism, and if it was dry and the static electricity caused lightning, earthquakes and lightning and floods and volcanic eruptions and all this stuff. This is exactly what the catastrophic history was all about. So fire is an integral part of all this. So fire is something that we're deeply afraid of. But we should actually honor all the little divas. Every time we have a little flame, a little candle, which I love to have, we should honor it as a fellow little living plasma being. Now, another interesting scientist I met in the mid-90s in Boulder, Colorado, his name was Margaret Galler from the Smithsonian Astrophysical Observatory, and she had done some really interesting work mapping out the three-dimensional, large-scale structure of the universe. And I never was able to get any of her photos, but one of the things that blew me away was that one of the largest structures she saw was actually quite similar in shape to this squatting man. It was kind of like a person with a neck and two arms and two legs that came out and extended out like a five-spoke radius. So if you tie that in with the plasma discharge thing, it's very, very, very interesting to think about. So something I'm delving into all this stuff right now, and also James Lovelock, who has gone off the deep end with his nuclear agenda, but his book about Gaia is really interesting because he talks about what living systems do. The atmosphere does not exist in a chemical equilibrium. It's in a continuous disequilibrium, which only something that's alive can maintain that. And so living systems are self-organizing thermodynamically in the Prigogenean sense, and also they're not only unpredictable but creative. Any little being, from an amoeba to a butterfly, especially to a person, an atmosphere, a climatological system, a planet, what any of these might do, regardless of what they're subjected to, with Frankenstein electrodes and chemical injections and all this different kind of stuff, it's unpredictable. And it's, so with all these mad Atlantean scientists trying to manipulate and control the geodynamics of the Earth for purposes of warfare and just sheer Oppenheimerian I have become death experimentation, we don't really know what the outcome's going to be. It's like Mother Earth, I feel, loves us, and she doesn't want to destroy us. We're doing a pretty good job of it ourselves, but I think the time is going to come when she will have had enough, and I think we're on that threshold right now, where some kind of process completely unknown to us, and I've tended to think a lot about comets and asteroids, and also about how, you know, the way that with all the mining that we've done, digging all the precious things from the land, we've actually damaged, we've ruptured the aura of the Earth and damaged the magnetic fields significantly. So this would, the magnetic fields has to do with how the Earth processes incoming cosmic rays and Birkeland currents and energies coming from other parts of the galaxy. So it's sort of like that. This would be a mechanism to explain why there might be a lot of anomalous weather and earthquakes and stuff too. On top of this, this would be part of the natural background that we're inadvertently affecting. So we've got, with my domain overlay complexity scenario, we've got the archaic natural processes there, on top of which are overlaid all the stuff that we're doing, both inadvertently, like from mining and pollution and electromagnetic fields and toxic waste, to deliberate planetary level geoengineering that's clearly being done. So I'll close on this note. There's a really interesting physicist and astronomer named Freeman Dyson, and he has some really interesting ideas about extraterrestrial intelligence. But he said, if we look for, like the SETI people want to look for microwaves, but he said if we look for heat, if we look at, for infrared sources, anomalous sources of heat outnumber microwave sources by orders of magnitude. So, anyway, I guess I better go. I've got to go pick up my friend Craig. He's the Yeti Buddhist meditating. He's been nice enough to let me use his car here at Maitland Beach, watching the yellow sun go down. I'm preparing to go up to Katoomba to be on the edge of the inferno tomorrow. But please send blessings for everybody, especially my friend Paul Selwood, a really well-known Australian sculptor who lives near Wallumbai. Very sadly, Mount Yango, the Uluru of the East Coast, where Craig and I went two times a few months ago and camped out, a very powerful sacred spot. It's all burned up, even the homestead that we went past and the sacred place where I played my flute and left some painted rocks and stuff. And Paul's house got cut off, the road got cut off yesterday, and he was going to stay and fight the fire. It was only 2 kilometers away, so I need to call him. And he said they had a back way out with four-wheel drive, but anyway, the koalas have been decimated. The fires are going on. The day of purification is at hand. This is not fire and brimstone. It's the plasma world. We're just encountering what most of the universe is made of. This is Jeff Phillips Wefferson signing off for UCY-TV On the Brink Radio. Please honor the cosmic fire in the plasma kingdom.
Good day. Yeah.